from whatever bad feeling she had. He could see that. She stayed up late, sitting at the kitchen table and pretending to work. Half the time he cooked dinner for her because she seemed to have forgotten to eat. She only pushed the food around on her plate, then stood and began to wash dishes. When she talked with people in town, she was calm and poised, though tired-looking. But beneath it, Edgar saw something fractured. And there was, he discovered, a kind of selfishness in him about those dreams. They might have been false memories, but they were memories nonetheless, stolen time. In the end, he just shrugged and headed out to start the morning chores. He hadn't fooled her, but they didn't talk about it either, which, for the time being, was good enough. His mother had him set up a low barrier in the mow, a pair of uprights with dowels sticking out, like a track and field hurdle. A rough curtain of red ribbon hung from the rod. She asked Edgar to bring up one of the dogs. At first he intended to use Essay, who loved to climb and jump. Then he remembered his mother's admonition about training the dogs on exercises they had already mastered, so he chose Finch instead. He stayed the dog on the far side of the barrier, then walked to his mother's side. "Have him jump the barrier," she said. She wasn't asking for a stupendous feat. The rod was on the lowest set of dowels, 6 inches above the floor. Finch could step over it. When Edgar signaled a recall, Finch wandered forward. He sniffed the uprights, then skirted them without stepping over the rod. He trotted the remaining distance and finished in front of Edgar, swishing his tail and glancing back and forth between the two of them. "What did you think of that?" his mother asked. "He did it wrong," Edgar sighed. "All right, let me put it another way. What did you do wrong?" "Nothing. He knew exactly what I wanted. He had to go out of his way to avoid it." "Is that so?" Edgar looked at Finch, whose mouth was hanging open slightly, ears erect, eyes shining with mischief. Of course Finch knew he was supposed to jump the barrier. Not only had Finch seen other dogs do the same thing, but Finch himself had jumped that barrier many times, even when it was set much higher. Though never reliably, Edgar had to admit. Certainly Finch wasn't scared of the barrier, as some dogs were. And on top of all that, it was obviously the shortest path between them. "Yes," he sighed. "You saw him." "Okay," his mother said. "We'll forget for a moment that when Finch finally got here, you didn't acknowledge it. He's still waiting for that, by the way, but he's a patient dog. He knows you'll get around to it. There's even a chance he won't have forgotten what you're praising him for by then. In the meantime, why don't you take him back around? Maybe we can do this over and figure out what the trouble is." Abashed, Edgar scratched Finch's chest and smoothed the fur over the dog's forehead. He looped his finger through his collar, but before he could take a step, his mother said, "Stop." He turned to look at her. "Why did you just praise Finch?" He laughed, silently, shoulders shaking. His mother seemed determined to ask absurd questions. "Because he came when called."
"Really?"
She looked puzzled. "Okay, well." She raised an arm and signaled them forward with a limp hand, a queen dismissing courtiers.
"Proceed."
He led Finch across the mow, giving the uprights a wide berth so as not to accidentally reinforce the incorrect path. When they'd gotten halfway back to the starting position, his mother again shouted, "Stop!" They stopped. The barrier was within reach of Edgar's left hand. Far away, near the mow door, his mother stood with her fingers woven into her hair like a madwoman, as if she couldn't believe what she was seeing.
"What in the world do you think you're doing?" she said.
This was an act, he knew, and it made him laugh all over again.
"Taking Finch to his stay spot."
"But you didn't go over the barrier."
"You didn't ask me to go over the barrier."
"Exactly," she said. "You see? You can't train a dog to do something if you don't know what you want him to do. When you recalled Finch, you didn't know what you wanted. How can I tell? Because you said one thing to him and expected something else, just like I did.
If I had known what I wanted from you, I would have asked for it. But I didn't know until you were already past the barrier. Now I know what I want. Come back here. You taught me what I want. Dutifully, he led Finch back to her side. Thank you, she said, bowing a little. You're welcome, he signed, bowing in return. He was having a hard time keeping the grin off his face. Who was the teacher in that exchange? He pointed at her. Oh, really? Oh, I taught you. So who was the teacher? I was. Right. What do you say when someone goes out of their way to teach you something? Thank you? Exactly. Why did you praise Finch before? Because he taught me something? Are you asking me or telling me? Telling. Because he taught me something. Exactly. When his mother dropped her theatrical stance and smiled, he wasn't sure where his tears came from. He didn't feel sad. In fact, he was laughing, but his vision suddenly blurred up. Tears of shock, he supposed, at discovering he'd spent his entire life on the kennel and yet still misunderstood something so elementary. And the force of her personality could be overwhelming. He turned away and passed a sleeve over his face before something even more embarrassing could happen. She watched for a moment. Oh, Edgar, she said, I don't mean to be hard on you. I'm just trying to make a point. Remember what I said about not being able to explain what people pay us for? I wasn't being coy. One of the things you need to learn is that training is almost never about words. I could try to explain these things, but the words wouldn't mean much. It's like what just happened here. I told you the words for this idea right when we started, but that didn't mean you understood them. But maybe now you see why someone would pay for a trained dog instead of a pup. He thought about this, then nodded. Especially another trainer. He nodded again. So why don't you take this fabulous teacher named Finch back over the barrier and stay him, and let's try again. This time she had him stand across the mow beside Finch with a short lead attached to his collar, and she performed the recall. Edgar ran alongside Finch and made sure he jumped the barrier. He only needed one correction and three trials. Then they switched, and she ran alongside him for three more trials, while Edgar did the recall. He thanked Finch each time for teaching him something. In return, the dog's eyes glinted, and he tried to put his feet on Edgar's chest and lick his face. Quite happily, Edgar let him. Dr. Papineau came for dinner several nights later. Here it is, he announced as he walked in. He was accompanied by a blast of cold air and a white bakery box held aloft like a prize. A longtime widower, Dr. Papineau patronized the cafes and bakeries between Park Falls and Ashland. He held strong opinions on who served the best of his favorite foods, from eggs over easy to strawberry cheesecake. Lemon meringue, he declared. I bought it by hand. This joke was part of the tradition as well. I told Betsy down at the Mellon Bakery to set aside the best she had. She did, too. She's got a little crush on me, I think, ever since I heroically removed her cat's kidney stones. Edgar's mother lifted the box from Papineau's hand. Well, she'll have to get in line behind the waitresses down in Park Falls, she said, smiling. Cold enough for you, Paige? Nope, he said cheerfully. I'd like to see it colder than this. Oh, really? She said. Why's that? Because when I'm soaking in the Florida sun, I like to read the newspaper and check the weather here. If I don't see solid minus signs, I feel cheated. Ah, yes, the annual migration. Ah, yes, I enjoy it more every year. They spent dinner talking about the kennel. Edgar's mother had taken one of the older dogs to see Dr. Papineau that week, and he had diagnosed hypothyroid. They talked about the medication. Then he inquired about how she and Edgar were holding up, commenting obliquely on how tired they looked. Trudy put him off. Things had been hard, she said, but they were under control. They had a schedule worked out.
Edgar's mother embroidered their success a bit. While it was true that things were slowly returning to normal, it also wasn't unusual for her to be in the barn until 9 o'clock, with another hour spent over paperwork at the kitchen table. Edgar worked evenings as well, pulling out dogs for grooming and training. He'd negotiated for 2 hours with them each night. Trudy said there had to be time for schoolwork, and if he was efficient, an hour and a half would be plenty for training. Saturdays were the exception. They slept as late as they wanted and ran errands in town. But even then, if Edgar happened to wake first, he'd sneak out to the barn and start the chores, hoping that just once his mother would open her eyes and realize there was nothing to do. Often, before he'd worked even 20 minutes, the barn doors would open and she would walk in, puffy-eyed, weary, and looking thinner every week. On top of it all, there was the cough she'd developed. It doubled her over sometimes.
"You two are doing an amazing job," Dr. Papineau said. "I can't believe how fast you've got back on your feet. I remember what it was like when Rose died. I wasn't fit for anything for months."
He looked thoughtful.
"I'm just wondering if you can keep up the pace."
"Why couldn't we?" his mother said. "It won't be long before the weather turns and things get so much easier when we can train outdoors. Then school lets out for the summer. It's going to make a big difference."
"And a couple of months later it'll start up again," Papineau said. He knew where the plates and silverware were, and he had dished out slices of pie. He liked to serve the desserts he brought.
"Well, what else can we do?" his mother said, looking cross. "There's only the two of us here. Maybe we'll have to skip a litter in the fall. That would make things tight, but I've been going over the finances, and we could make ends meet. I'm sorry if that means your share is going to be a little smaller, but it's the best we can do for now."
Papineau waved her comment aside with his fork.
"What I'm wondering is, have you considered that maybe the real solution involves three people?"
"Meaning?"
"Meaning there's a Sawtelle boy in town who knows this kennel inside and out."
"Claude is hardly a boy," his mother said. "And you know how things ended between him and Gar."
"Water under the bridge, isn't it?" "He's been helping me out of the office, Trudy, and I have to tell you that he still has a gift. I remember what he was like 20 years ago.
"And we both know how he learned all that. You don't get good at ministering to torn-up dogs unless you're around them a lot."
"Okay, okay. I didn't come here to debate Claude's past. The thing is, where is the slack in your schedule, Trudy? There's no room for anything to go wrong. And eventually, something always does. Look at last year. How many things that happened could you have planned for? Now, I'm not talking about Gar. I mean in the kennel. Your barn was hit by a tornado. Did you plan for that? I seem to recall at least one nursing mother last year with mastitis. And we both know how much time bottle feeding takes. Have you planned for that?"
"All right, Paige, here's a question. Suppose we hired someone to help out. How would I pay him? The money isn't there. We make ends meet. We pay our bills. We have a little savings, period. That truck isn't going to last much longer, and when it's time to buy a new one, I don't want to be firing hired help to do it. I won't even start down that road."
"It was just an idea, Trudy," Dr. Papineau said. "I'm trying to help."
"It was a bad idea," she said. "Is that why you're here? To protect your investment?"
It finally began to dawn on Edgar what the references to Dr. Papineau's share meant. He signed a question at his mother, but she shook her head angrily and stood and stalked around the table. She ended up standing by the counter where Dr. Papineau had left the pie tin and in a single swift motion pitched it into the trash.
"I may not have been born here, but that doesn't mean I don't know how this place operates after 20 years. 20 years, let me remind you, during which Claude was most definitely not here."
Edgar's mother was 41 years old at that moment. He knew she could mask her feelings perfectly when she wanted to, because there were dogs who misbehaved expressly to get a reaction, not caring whether it was pleasure or anger. Oftentimes it wasn't until much later that he understood a dog had gotten under her skin.
She was certainly capable of that same self-control during a dinner conversation, and yet there she stood, giving herself over to anger, almost reveling in it. The dark circles under her eyes had disappeared. Her shoulders had dropped into a relaxed readiness, her posture suddenly sinuous and limber, like a dancer or a lioness. She looked as if she might as easily spring onto the table as curl up to sleep. Partly calculated, he supposed, to look as far from helpless as possible, wholly in control of their fate, but partly also a surrender to her own willfulness. He thought he ought to be scared by such a magisterial fit of temper, but in truth, he'd never felt safer in his life. Dr. Papineau, however, was entirely daunted. He tipped his chair back onto its rear legs and held his hands out.
"Whoa," he said. "Your decision. I'm not suggesting you do anything that doesn't feel right. But think about this. Eventually something will go wrong. What are you going to do then? And that's all I'm saying. What are you going to do then?"
"Yes," Trudy said, after Dr. Papineau had left. "He has a stake in the kennel, 10%.
"Are there others?" Edgar asked.
"No. Years ago, when we were strapped for money, Paige helped us out. Back then it was impossible to get a loan, so he paid us $5,000 in exchange for a share in the kennel. He has obligations, though."
"That's why you never pay him for vet work?"
"Right."
"What about Claude?"
"Claude sold your father his share in the kennel when your grandfather died." Edgar had more questions, but suddenly his mother looked exhausted, and there would be plenty of chances to ask in the morning. Time and again, Edgar reread the letters from Brooks. They were like a puzzle to be solved. Brooks was given to proclamations and dire warnings. Pitched arguments were made for or against the importance of gait, hocks, flanks, the function of the tail, the optimum angle of the pasterns, how much this might vary between the fortunate Fields lines and the Sawtell dogs, whether one could ever discriminate between willingness to work and more general intelligence, whether body sensitivity was learned or inherited. The arguments often ascended into theory. Brooks sounded like a man dragging John Sawtell into the age of science. "I have the advantage of knowing," he wrote, "that long after I am gone, my work will provide a foundation upon which future generations of dogs, breeders, and trainers may build. Skill and talent alone are not enough. If these are bound up in you and you alone, and not in data and precisely recorded procedures, what will your efforts amount to? A few dogs, a few successes, then nothing. Only the briefest flash of light in the darkness." There had been some setback in 1935, though Edgar couldn't tell what it was. Some illness had flashed through the kennel, perhaps, or some spectacular training failure. In any case, it was serious enough for Brooks to shift from debate to encouragement. "There is nothing to do now but take stock of your accomplishments," he wrote. "Now your records must serve you instead of the dogs. Study them. Look at how many of your dogs have succeeded in the world. Your records are a history of your accomplishments, John. They will show you why you undertook this work in the first place." Edgar had never seen his father capriciously select a dog for breeding, but in those early days there was nothing yet to call a Sawtell dog, just John Sawtell's dogs. What drove Brooks mad was Edgar's grandfather's habit of spotting a dog on the street and deciding it carried some essential quality. The replies from New Jersey sometimes rose to a shriek. "How many times have we argued about this, John? Every time you do this, you introduce more variability into your bloodlines than you will ever profit by. Why do you place your trust in chance?" Edgar arranged the letters from Brooks in chronological order. The last of them seemed to close the argument forever. December 16, 1944, Morristown, New Jersey. John, you may be the most stubborn man I've ever met. Let me rebut your points one last time, though I fear no one will ever change your mind on this. At least we are in agreement that by careful documentation of phenotype, one can increase or decrease the preponderance of a quality if one measures it objectively and reinforces it for many generations through selective breeding. The poorest farmer knows this can be done and benefits from it. He chooses Herefords, Holsteins, or Guernseys, depending on his needs. He has definite opinions on whether a Percheron or a Belgian should stand in the traces. Likewise, we apply the scientific principles of heredity toward the perfection of a breed, so that instead of only one dog out of two litters being suitable for service, 90% make the grade. How are we doing this? By defining and measuring those qualities that make a good working dog. And this is where we differ. You feel less need to choose specific traits a priori, believing instead that excellent traits will simply emerge if the finest individuals, taken as a whole, are brought into the line. Let us employ the metaphor of salt. We can't see the salt in a glass of water, but we can taste it. Combining two slightly salty glasses and reducing them gives us a saltier result. Done enough, the invisible becomes visible. Salt crystals. We may not have set out to create salt crystals, but now we have them. This is analogous to what you propose. You have cleverly arranged to work with strong brine. You don't know what you will find if you continue to distill it, only that this tastes ever so slightly saltier than that. And so, by the seat of your pants, you choose one cross over another. At Fortunate Fields, on the other hand, we not only know we are trying to produce salt crystals, we know the desired size, shape, and color of those crystals. And we've carefully documented the salinity of the sire and dam of every litter, as well as their offspring. Yet, I have seen your records, and you are nearly as rigorous as Fortunate Fields. I confess, our rigor and precision wearies me at times. I don't claim our process is easy, quite the opposite. If this were easy, it would have been done long ago. But I do claim that it's the only way to obtain reliable results. In the end, the difference between you and me comes down to the difference between an artist and a factory man. The artist doesn't know what he wants, but looks for good paint, good brushes, and good canvas. He trusts that talent will produce a desirable result. Sadly, for most people, it doesn't. The factory man says, "What can I make that I can rely on? It may not be the ideal, but I must be able to tell my customers that each time they buy, they will receive the same product." The factory man values predictability above mere excellence for good reason. Would you frequent a bakery where one cake in 10 was inspired, but the other 9 inedible? I realize this portrays you as the romantic figure and me as the plotter. Perhaps you think that diminishes me. I do not. Change the analogy from bread to medicine, and you will feel the same urgency I do. You might be willing to gamble on the odd cake, but if your infant is sick, you will choose the medicine with predictable results every time. I sacrifice brilliance to make a good medicine available to mankind. No one can say if you are that person who, given good paint, good brushes, and a fine canvas, can produce something better than the factory man. That is, and always has been, beyond the realm of science. You do have the attitude of the dreamer about you. For that reason, I haven't the heart to argue any more about this. It is a hopeless task. And for a simple factory man like me, an effort must be abandoned once its hopelessness is exposed. Only the artist perseveres in such circumstances. However, I'll leave you with a question. Suppose, guided only by intuition, you capture the greatness you seek. Never mind that you cannot define greatness scientifically. What makes you think you will even recognize it when it appears? Some believe that gross animal behavior may be reducible to a set of simple, indivisible traits, and that only the multiplicity of ways in which those traits combine creates the illusion of complexity. Suppose you stumble across one small change with dozens of ramifications in the gross behavior of the animal. How will you know what you've done? How will you ever achieve it again? The painter who creates one masterpiece, never to produce another, is well known. If you have a success, it will most likely be singular.
Can you be satisfied with that, John?
Almandine. To her, the scent and the memory of him were one. Where it lay strongest, the distant past came to her as if that morning, taking a dead sparrow from her jaws before she knew to hide such things. Guiding her to the floor, bending her knee until the arthritis made it stick, his palm hot-sided on her ribs to measure her breaths and know where the pain began, and to comfort her. That had been the week before he went away. He was gone, she knew this, but something of him clung to the baseboards. At times the floor quivered under his footstep. She stood then and nosed into the kitchen and the bathroom and the bedroom, especially the closet, her intention to press her ruff against his hand, run it along his thigh, feel the heat of his body through the fabric. Places, times, weather, all these drew him up inside her. Rain, especially, falling past the double doors of the kennel where he'd waded through so many storms, each drop throwing a dozen replicas into the air as it struck the waterlogged earth. And where the rising and falling water met, something like an expectation formed, a place where he might appear and pass in long strides, silent and gestureless. For she wasn't without her own selfish desires, to hold things motionless, to measure herself against them and find herself present, to know that she was alive precisely because he needn't acknowledge her in casual passing. That utter constancy might prevail if she attended the world so carefully. And if not constancy, then only those changes she desired, not those that sapped her, undefined her. And so she searched. She'd watched his casket lowered into the ground, a box man-made, no more like him than the trees that swayed under the winter wind. To assign him an identity outside the world was not in her thinking. The fence line where he walked and the bed where he slept, that was where he lived, and they remembered him. Yet he was gone. She knew it most keenly in the diminishment of her own self. In her life, she'd been nourished and sustained by certain things, him being one of them, Trudy another, and Edgar the third and most important. But it was really the three of them together, intersecting in her, for each of them powered her heart a different way. Each of them bore different responsibilities to her and with her, and required different things from her. And her day was the fulfillment of those responsibilities. She couldn't imagine that portion of her would never return. With her, it wasn't hope or wistful thoughts. It was her sense of being alive that thinned by the proportion of her spirit devoted to him. As spring came on, his scent about the place began to fade. She stopped looking for him. Whole day she slept beside his chair, as the sunlight drifted from eastern slant to western slant, moving only to ease the weight of her bones against the floor. And Trudy and Edgar, encapsulated in mourning, somehow forgot to care for one another, let alone her. Or if they knew, their grief and heartache overwhelmed them. Anyway, there was so little they might have done, save to bring out a shirt of his to lie on. Perhaps walk with her along the fence line where fragments of time had snagged and hung. But if they noticed her grief, they hardly knew to do those things. And she, without the language to ask. The fight. His mother's cough was bad in the mornings, though it was gone by the time they'd finished chores. At school one afternoon, he was called to the office. His mother had telephoned. She would pick him up in the circle drive fronting the school. At first he thought nothing of it. Sometimes errands coincided with the end of the school day. He waited under the long roofed entry as the buses revved their engines and lumbered forward. He didn't see the pickup until they were gone. His mother sat in the cab, head tipped back until a coughing fit curled her forward. He trotted up the sidewalk, watching the truck rock on its springs. When he opened the door, the heater was blasting. "What happened?" he sighed. "You look terrible." "I'm not sure. I got dizzy working in the Mao and went to the house to lie down. This thing has gotten..." She thumped her chest lightly, which triggered a spasm of coughing. She crossed her fists over her chest and doubled up, then rested her hands on the steering wheel. When she looked over at him, her face was shining with sweat. "I called," she began, then switched to sign. "I called Dr. Frost." "When can you see him?" She looked at her watch. 10 minutes ago." "Then go," he signed. "Go." Dr. Frost practiced out of a converted house east of town. His waiting room contained a half dozen chairs and a coffee table covered with ancient National Geographic magazines. A tall, narrow window had been cut into the back wall for his receptionist. Before they could sit down, the doctor appeared, sandy-haired, with wire-rimmed glasses, and led Edgar's mother to an examination room. Edgar sat on the couch and looked out the windows. The sun was sinking below the treetops. A pair of jays screamed at each other from the pine trees, launching themselves into loopy, tumbling flights. From inside the exam room came an indistinct conversation. "Again, please," he heard Dr. Frost say, and another fit of coughing. A moment later, the doctor appeared at the receptionist's window. "Edgar," he said, "why don't you come back and join the party?" In the examination room, Trudy sat in the corner on a chair. Dr. Frost patted the black exam bench and asked Edgar to untuck his shirt, and he pressed a stethoscope against his ribs. "Cough," he said. Edgar exhaled a quiet gasp. "Clear," the doctor murmured. He jotted a note on his pad and turned and pressed his thumbs into the soft skin under Edgar's jaw, looking absently into space. Then he looked down Edgar's throat with a small lighted examination scope. "Say ah." "A-H-H-H-H," he fingerspelled. Dr. Frost glanced at his mother. "He just said ah for you," she said weakly and smiling. "Okay, sense of humor intact," the doctor said. "Try anyway." Then he clapped Edgar's shoulder and told him to button up. He folded his arms across his clipboard and looked at them. "Edgar's lungs are clear. He hasn't picked up what you have, Trudy, which is pneumonia. I need to run a lab test on that sputum sample, but there's really not much doubt. The crackle in your right lung is pronounced. I'm tempted to send you up to Ashland for chest x-rays, but I'm going to hold off and maybe save you a little money. Right now, this is mild, and you're a young woman, and we're catching it early. We're going to get you on antibiotics and knock it out quick. There's a catch, though." "This is mild?" his mother interjected. "Relatively, though I wish you'd come in 3 or 4 days ago. This stuff is nothing to fool with. I'm not trying to alarm you, but I want you to understand that pneumonia is dangerous. People die from it. Any worse and I'd have you in the hospital." His mother shook her head and started to say something, but before she could speak, a coughing fit took her. Dr. Frost waved his hand. I know, a possibility we want to avoid. So you're going to have to do what I say, all right?" She nodded. Dr. Frost looked at Edgar until he nodded, too. "Here's my concern. Edgar's cough reflex is abnormal. Coughing involves constricting the vocal cords, which, as we know, is difficult for him. With pneumonia, coughing is good and bad. It's bad because it wears you out, but it's good because it gets the crud out of your lungs. If Edgar catches this, he'll naturally be less inclined to cough, and the bad stuff will accumulate in his lungs. That would be worse than for the ordinary person. Much worse. Understand?" Again, they both nodded. Dr. Frost looked at Edgar's mother. "It would be ideal if Edgar stayed somewhere else for a week." She shook her head. "There's nowhere else. Nowhere? How about with Claude? She laughed wheezily and rolled her eyes, but there was a flash of anger in her expression as well. Edgar could see her thinking, small-town busybodies. Absolutely not.
All right, then we have to minimize contact between you two for the next 10 days. No meals together, no sitting around in the living room watching television, no hugs and kisses. Can you quarantine a portion of your house? Someplace you can sleep and keep the doors closed?
Not perfectly. I can close my bedroom door, but it opens onto the kitchen, and there's only one bathroom.
I don't like that, but I suppose it'll have to do. I realize I'm suggesting extraordinary measures here, but this is an unusual situation.
He turned back to the chart and scribbled. When he finished, he looked up.
There's one other thing, Trudy. You need bed rest. Don't cheat on that.
How long?
A week. 10 days would be better. You're going to sleep as much as you can for the next week.
You're joking.
Not in the least. I'm telling you, Trudy, don't push this thing. Antibiotics aren't miracle drugs. If you run yourself down, they won't help.
He turned to Edgar.
Edgar, if you start feeling like you have a chest cold, if your chest gets tight, let Trudy know. Sometimes people don't want to admit they're getting sick, but if you play that game, it's going to be tough. Understood?
Dr. Frost led them to the waiting room. He appeared in a few minutes at the receptionist's window with a prescription and a vial of pills, handed Edgar's mother a Dixie cup filled with water, and had her swallow the first dose on the spot.
In the truck, Edgar sat, listening to the whistle in his mother's breath. She frowned and turned on the radio.
"I'll be fine," she said. "Quit worrying."
They drove on, music crackling over the truck speaker.
"You're going to have to do the kennel by yourself."
"I know." When they got home, Trudy went to her bedroom, pulled off her shoes, and dragged the blankets over her shoulders. Edgar stood in the doorway and watched her.
"Is spring break next week?"
"Yes."
"I'll call the school and have you excused until then."
"Okay."
"Maybe your teachers can send assignments home on the school bus."
"Okay."
"About the kennel, just get the chores done. Check the pups every morning and night. Don't worry about training."
"I can do some training."
"Then work your litter the most. Nothing fancy. One dog in motion at a time. Remember that."
"Okay, okay."
"Spend as much time as you can in the kennel. Take books. Stay out of the house unless you need to eat, sleep, or..." Before she could finish, a cough racked her shoulders off the bed. When she stopped, she was propped up on one arm, panting.
"What if you need something?"
"I won't need anything. I can make soup and toast for myself. I'm going to be sleeping anyway. Now, close the door, please."
He stood memorizing her features under the yellow lamplight. She pointed at the door.
"Out," she mouthed.
When he and Amandine returned to the house that night, the bedroom door was closed, and his mother's wind-up alarm clock sat on the kitchen table. He turned off the kitchen light and held the clock to his ear and looked at the green radium dots on the tips of the hands. A glow shone yellow beneath the bedroom door. He eased the door open. On the bed, his mother lay in a fetal curl, her eyes closed. Her exhalations sounded ever so slightly easier than they had that afternoon. He stood watching and listening for a long time. Almandine pushed past him into the room and scented his mother's thin hand, resting lax and upturned on the sheet, and returned to his side. He closed the bedroom door and stood thinking, turning the wind-up alarm over and over in his hands. Then he walked upstairs. He pulled the blankets off his bed and squeezed his pillow under his elbow and carried them out to the barn. He pushed together 4 bales of straw in the aisle between the pens, and he spread the blankets over the bales and sat and unlaced his shoes and looked at the row of light bulbs shining over the aisle. He trotted barefoot to the front doors and flipped the light switch.
A clap of dark filled the kennel. He flipped the switch up again and took a galvanized pail from the workshop and worked his way along the aisle, stepping onto the upturned pail and licking his fingertips against the heat of the bulbs. He unscrewed all but one, and that far down near the whelping rooms. In the semi-dark, he twisted the knob on the back of the clock until the alarm hand pointed to 5, then set the clock on the bales beside the pillow and lay back. Almondine stood on the cement, watching him doubtfully. "Come on," he sighed, patting the bales. "It's just like in the house." She circled the setup, then climbed aboard and lay with her muzzle near his face. Wind rattled the doors. A pup yipped from the whelping rooms. He pressed his hand into the plush on Alma Dean's chest, feeling its rise and fall, rise and fall. He was genuinely terrified of getting sick. It was going to be hard enough keeping his mother in bed. If she thought he was sick, she would do the kennel work anyway, and then she would end up hospitalized. And yet, despite his apprehensions, the prospect of running the kennel alone excited him. He wanted to prove he could do it, that nothing would go wrong. And now that he'd begun to see the real problems in training, he felt so many possibilities whenever he worked his dogs. There was another feeling as well, something darker and harder to think through, because there was a part of him that wanted to be away from her. Ever since the funeral, they depended on each other so heavily that it was a relief to be alone, self-reliant. Perhaps he thought distancing himself from his mother might distance the fact of his father's death. He understood that might be part of it, and if so, it was an illusion. But that didn't change how he felt. He lay under the gaze of the kennel dogs, his hand on Amandine's side, and thought about being alone. While he was eating breakfast, his mother talked to him through the closed door, pausing to catch her breath at disturbing intervals. "Have you been to the barn yet?" He swung the bedroom door halfway open. She looked at him glassy-eyed. "Everything's okay. Are you okay?" "About the same. Real tired. Have you taken those pills?" "Yes," she said. "I mean, not yet. I will when I eat breakfast." "I'll make it for you." He expected her to say no, but she nodded. "Just toast and strawberry jam and orange juice. Just set it on the table before you go." He closed the bedroom door. He mixed up the orange juice, toasted the toast, and covered it with plenty of jam, his heart pounding all the while. When he looked in again, she was asleep. He waited a moment, trying to decide what the right thing to do was, then knocked on the door. "I'm up," she said groggily. "Breakfast is ready," he signed. "I'll check back at noon." For the next 3 days, he knew she'd been awake only because the breakfasts he'd prepared were gone at lunchtime, and the soup eaten when he checked at night. She must have called the school because the bus didn't slow down at their driveway. Invariably, she was asleep when he looked in on her, a book splayed out on the covers beyond her fingertips. Whenever he woke her, she seemed startled. It took a minute for her to make sense of his questions. He asked how she felt. She said she could tell the antibiotics were working. She asked if there were problems in the kennel. He said no. They both lied. Each night Edgar lay awake, ridiculously tormented by the wind-up clock, which, along with its ticking, issued a ratcheting, grinding noise he'd never noticed before. When he finally managed to sleep, his father appeared beside his makeshift bed. So close and real, Edgar didn't believe he was dreaming, until he found himself sitting up and Almondine licking his face. The fourth morning, he fumbled the jangling alarm into silence and promptly fell back into slumber, worrying even then that he might dream of his father again, and worrying equally that he might not. Instead, he dreamed he could breathe words effortlessly into the air. The ability hadn't just appeared, it had returned, as if he'd had a voice in the womb, but lost it when he'd entered the world. And in his dream, he had chosen not to speak into the telephone, not to summon the ambulance that would have saved his father's life. He woke, frantic, sobbing. It took a moment before he could marshal the courage to draw a breath, shape his lips, and exhale. Silence. The awful thing was, his voice sounded all wrong in his dream, low like his father's and gravelly. But any voice coming from inside him would have sounded wrong, no less than the buzzing fly noise from the flashlight-shaped thing the doctors had pressed against his neck. That had given him a voice, but it hadn't been worth it. Unless, of course, he'd had it the day his father fell down in the barn. He began to take shortcuts with the kennel routine. In order to train all the dogs, he raced through the chores. He found he could clean 3 or 4 pens while he fed the dogs if he dumped a pile of food on the cement. Something told him this was a bad idea, but it worked. At night, the dogs seemed edgy, but that was because the schedule had changed. No one slept in the kennel night after night, much less ran down the aisle and threw open their pen doors to let them race after tennis balls. The late-night training, he told himself, was excellent proofing practice. It was past midnight on the fourth day when he finally stretched out on the bales and pulled the blankets over him. He'd turned out all the lights and settled himself beside Almandine when he heard his name spoken in a distinct, feminine voice. He sat up and listened. It had only been the squeak of the heater fan, he decided. A few minutes later, a thought began to nag at him. What if it hadn't been the heater fan at all? What if his mother was standing on the back porch calling? He cast off his blanket and threw open the barn doors, but all he saw was a barren yard and the porch standing dark and empty. In some ways, Trudy thought, it would have been better if the antibiotics had made her downright sick. As it was, she lay in bed, chilled one moment, boiling the next. She was indifferent to food, though she forced herself to eat. On the third day, she'd called Dr. Frost's office, as promised, hoping she was saying what he wanted to hear. She was tired, she told him, but not feverish. She was sleeping a lot. That was normal, Frost said. She should beware of dehydration. Be careful not to skip doses of the antibiotics. They talked briefly about Edgar. She told the doctor he showed no sign of a cough. Did she think she could drive into town at the end of the week? Was her cough still productive? And so on. She didn't mention that she grew sickeningly dizzy whenever she stood, or that she'd been so foggy-minded she'd forgotten his phone number twice while dialing. She might have stretched the truth about the fever, but she kept focused long enough to maintain the conversation, which felt like a triumph. Afterward, she fell back into bed. Was it time for her next set of pills, or had she taken them? One late afternoon had begun to look much like the next, but she was sure she had taken the pills before she called Frost. The antibiotics made her terribly sleepy. She recalled Edgar standing in the bedroom doorway, telling her that things were going smoothly in the kennel. He'd grown so serious since his father's death. She rolled over. Sleep was the important thing. The way these things worked, tomorrow she would wake up on the other side of it. The fever would have broken, and she would sit up, read a bit, make some phone calls, get on top of the paperwork. She took the vial of pills from the dresser and shook them onto the blanket and counted them. It was surprising. So many left. On the fifth evening, Edgar slipped into the house, checked on his mother, and ate dinner. After washing dishes, he and Almandine walked to the barn to do the chores. But when they got there, exhaustion settled on him like a lead blanket. The straw bales felt luxurious, the pillows soft as a cloud. And for the first night in a long time, there were no dreams. He awoke with Almandine breathing in his face. The wind-up alarm clock said 2 o'clock. He sat up and rubbed a hand across his face. There was something wrong with that. He hadn't done the evening chores. He could get away with leaving everything else until morning, but he didn't like the idea of leaving the dogs without water. And as long as he was going to do that, he could feed them, too. He scooped a mound of kibble into the middle of the aisle and filled a bucket of water from the tap in the medicine room. When he threw open their doors, his litter bounded into the aisle, bumping his legs and dashing for the food. He'd piled up enough for all the dogs, not just 3 or 4 pens worth, and he needed them to get out fast so that the first ones didn't gorge themselves and leave the last ones hungry. By the time he'd gone down the aisle, 18 dogs were scrambling over the cement floor, jockeying for position. Edgar stepped into a pen and began to fill the water trough. He never saw what started the fight. There was a yelp, and from the corner of his eye he saw a dog leap into the air. Finch. He dropped the pail of water and stepped into the aisle, and that was all the time it took for him to realize the enormity of his mistake. One dog in motion at a time, his mother had said. It was one of many rules in the kennel, rules that didn't always make sense or even seem important until some situation drew the lesson out. Finch landed and nosed his right hind leg and turned back to the mass of dogs, head lowered, grimacing nastily to show his teeth. He spun to face one of the older females, a dog named Epi, dominant in her litter, bigger than Finch, and not in the least fearful. In all his life, Edgar had only seen one real dogfight. That had been broken up when his parents sprayed water on the antagonists, hauling them away by their tails. Later, his father said, a person never, ever reached between fighting dogs. To make this point, he pulled up his sleeve and showed Edgar the puckered scar running along the axis of his forearm, jagged and shiny. A dog in a fight will bite before it realizes what it's doing, he'd said. It won't mean to hurt you, but it will see motion and react. Some of the dogs were backing away from Finch and Epi, hackles raised. Edgar clapped his hands, grabbed 2 dogs, and hauled them into the nearest pen. Then another 2. The noise had grown instantly deafening. He kenneled Tinder, Essay, and Pout. Babu had already retreated to his run. Edgar shoved Opal and Umbra in after him and ran down the aisle, wrestling dogs into their pens one after another and slinging shut the doors. When he turned, only 3 dogs remained in the kennel aisle, Finch, Epi, and Almondine. Finch lay on his back. Epi stood over him, jaws buried in the fur at the base of his throat. On her muzzle there was a smear of red. Finch alternately lay limp and struggled to escape. A pace away, Almondine stood with her lips raised, growling. But the moment she stepped forward, Epi released Finch and lashed her muzzle toward Almondine, ears flattened. Almondine jerked her head away, but stood her ground. The important thing was to separate them. Edgar ran forward, coming at Epi from behind. He thought briefly of kicking her, to force her away, but he'd have to kick hard, maybe hard enough to injure her, and he wouldn't do that. Anyway, he was too close and running too fast. When he reached Epi's hindquarters, he simply threw himself at her. Later, he would try to understand it all from Epi's point of view. Someone had appeared over her shoulder. A dog's eyes are oriented along the axis of their muzzle, with less peripheral vision than a human being. Edgar intended to thread his fingers through her collar and pin her to the ground, using the momentum of his fall, like his mother sometimes did when a dog refused to down. Done right, a dog would be flattened before it had time to resist. If you had enough surprise, if you used enough force, if you got a solid grip on its collar. Edgar wound up with none of these. Epi threw her body sideways until her hind feet skidded out on the smooth cement. She could have turned and fled, but her mind was geared toward engagement, and by the time Edgar rolled onto his side, she towered over him. All he could do was loop 2 fingers through her collar, but without his hands free, he couldn't issue a command, and Epi wouldn't have obeyed anyway. If it was idiotic to step into a dogfight, it was suicidal to fall into one. He lay on his back, Epi's body suspended over him, all arcs of muscle and fur. And before he could move, she stepped back, arched her neck, and bit him. In fact, she bit him twice, lightning fast. The first time, her teeth barely touched his skin, as if she were taking bearings. But the second time was for real, and by then he was resigned to it, even felt she had the right. The surprise was that she restrained herself, suppressed the bite pressure that could have crushed the bones in his forearm, checked the upward jerk that could have sliced across tendon, muscle, and vein from wrist to elbow in a track just like his father's. Instead, a flicker of recognition appeared in her amber eyes. She was a good dog, just besieged and confused. And when the point of her canine tooth penetrated his arm, she froze. Then Almandine's muzzle entered his field of vision from the right. She was taking no chances. Epi was younger and stronger, and if Almandine had ever been in a dogfight, it was so long past that Edgar couldn't recall it. But Almandine didn't want to fight. She wanted Epi off him, off her boy. She didn't bark or growl. She didn't try to bite Epi's neck or harry Epi into releasing Edgar's arm. At that moment, Almandine had one idea: to blind Epi. Trudy sat up in bed, annoyed and confused. In her dream, Gar had been on the television, talking to her. So it was terrible enough to wake up at all. And doubly bad when she understood that what had woken her was the dogs, barking and crying, every one of them. Her first thought was that an animal had gotten into the barn. This happened every so often, though God knew why, since the place surely reeked of dog. But once inside, the sounds either paralyzed the animal or drove it into a mindless panic. One time it had been a raccoon, another, unbelievably, a cat. The uproar that had ensued sounded alarmingly, like what she now heard coming from the barn. She tried to stand, but lost her balance and began to cough. A yellow haze spread across her vision. Pain shot along her ribs. She sat down in the corner of the bed. The house was pitch dark. She tried calling to Edgar, but she couldn't raise her voice above a whisper. When she felt strong enough to stand again, she made her way slowly to the bottom of the stairs. "Edgar," she said. "Edgar?" She waited for a light to come on in his room, or for Almandine to appear. When neither happened, she walked up the stairs. At the top of the stairs, she paused for breath. His bedroom door was open. She walked to the doorway and turned on the overhead light. The sheets had been carelessly pulled off, the pillow and blankets gone. She made her way down the stairs again, her movements slow and cautious. Something bad was happening in the barn. She pulled on a pair of slacks and a shirt over her nightgown, slipped her feet into unlaced boots, and opened the door. Edgar's eyes were fixed on the sight of Epi's jaws on his forearm, how the skin had rucked up around her canine tooth like a loose stocking. There was no blood yet and no pain, only a pulling sensation in the skin of his arm. And so, lying there on the floor, all he saw was a blur, and then a gash opened near Epi's eye. Then Almandine's muzzle was stretched wide next to Epi's face, and a sound came from her he'd never before heard from a dog. Not a bark, but a scream, so raw and ferocious and bloody that, for all the baying and howling of the dogs until that moment, the kennel might as well have been silent. Epi released his arm and scrambled backward. But before he could move, Almandine had straddled him. And when he tried to sit up, she thumped him with her hip hard enough to knock him over, as if he were a pup. He had to scoot from beneath her to climb to his feet. Her pelt contracted when he touched her. Epi had retreated to the front of the barn, alternately growling and nosing the door. A trail of black drops led across the cement. She pawed at her muzzle and shook her head. Edgar led Almandine to the medicine room and flashed his hands over her. She wasn't cut or bleeding. He stayed her firmly and turned to Finch. He led the dog to the center of the aisle where the light was brightest. He wouldn't take any weight on his left front foot. When Edgar tried to examine him, Finch jerked his leg away, but not before Edgar saw the gash near the dog's left elbow and a flash of white through the dog's blood-matted coat. He ran his hands along Finch's muzzle and throat. His fingers came back wet, but not bloody. "Kennel up," he signed. Finch hobbled to his pen. Once the latch was closed, he turned to Eppy, pacing near the front door. Whenever he made eye contact with her, she flattened her ears against her skull and lifted her hackles. Her cheek looked like it had been opened with a knife. The sight made his heart thud. He'd knelt and begun to coax Eppy forward when the door swung open and his mother stood illuminated against the night. Instantly, Eppy bolted, forcing his mother to step back and grab the door to keep her balance. She watched Eppy flee into the darkness, then turned to Edgar. "What are you doing here?" he signed frantically. "What's going on?" "There was a problem, a fight. But it's the middle of the night. Your arm, are you hurt?" He looked down. Blood was smeared across his shirt sleeve. He couldn't tell if it was his or Finch's. He pushed it flat against his side, hoping to conceal the gash on his forearm. "I don't think so, not much. But Eppy's face is cut. She's going to need stitches. Almandine bit her. Finch is lame. I can't tell how bad." His mother teetered and corrected herself. "You shouldn't be outside," he signed. "Go back to the house." He tried to turn her around. "Oh, my God," she said. "Look at your arm." "Go back to the house. First, let's do that." "Edgar, I'm here already. I might as well stay." "No. Dr. Frost said you could end up in the hospital. He said you could die." She started to respond, but a coughing fit doubled her over. When it passed, he steered her into the night. It wasn't especially cold for spring, but neither was it warm, and he wanted to get her to the house. Then he remembered Almandine. She sat near the medicine room, watching them from the aisle. He clapped his leg, but she wouldn't budge. "Come on," he signed. "Come on. We don't have time to screw around." She took a few steps forward, then faltered and sank to the cement. He turned to his mother. "Just go," he signed. "Please." Almandine was up again by the time he reached her, walking unsteadily toward the door. He hovered alongside. "What is it?" he signed. "What? What?" By the time he'd slung the kennel doors closed after her, she'd regained some equilibrium, and she trotted behind his mother. He shooed them all up the porch steps. Once inside, Almandine lay down again, panting. He dropped to his knees beside her. "Something's wrong," he signed. "She stumbled back in the barn." "Was she bitten?" "No, I checked." He slid his hand under her belly and motioned her up. He lifted her feet and flexed her joints, watching for a wince. His mother made him describe Finch's injuries and Eppy's. She didn't ask how any of it had happened, or how Almandine had been involved. She just looked at Edgar like he wasn't making sense. "We need to call someone," Edgar signed. He kicked the floor in frustration. His mother began to talk through the options. "Paige is in Florida until..." She glanced at the calendar on the wall. "It's what, Wednesday? He won't be back until next Monday." "I'm not talking about Dr. Papineau," he signed. "There's no use calling that vet in Ashland. Not in the middle of the night. He'll never..." But Edgar was shaking his head. "Well, what then?" she said, annoyed. "If we can get them in the truck, I could drive..." He lifted the telephone receiver and set it on the countertop. "Call Claude," he signed. "Call him right now." Eppie's stand. Trudy sat at the table and watched Edgar close the kitchen door as he headed out again to find Eppie. She'd made coffee, hoping it would clear her head, and a cup sat on the table, issuing ribbons of steam. The overhead light starred and sparked in the periphery of her vision. She found it hard not to squint, and would have walked to the switch to turn off the lights, but she lacked the energy and possibly the balance. Something had changed. It was difficult to gauge exactly what, but every movement ached. She could draw a deep breath, but when she exhaled, there was a wheeze in her right lung. The sound transmitted through her flesh and bones. She shivered and sweated at the same time. This is the sort of thing that made people believe in possession, she thought. And she did feel inhabited, taken over, usurped by something blind and ferocious. What had Dr. Frost said about the antibiotics? How long before they took hold? The walls of the kitchen receded alarmingly. She felt a doubling, a sense of being inside her body and floating above herself at the same time. She closed her eyes to shut it out. After a time, she jerked awake. Just stay awake, she told herself. But the reason escaped her. She stood. She made her way toward the bedroom, watching it all from above, her blue and shrunken hands reaching forward, gripping the counter. Almondine lying on her side by the refrigerator, panting. The kitchen table with the now cool cup of coffee. The feed store calendar with a picture of a farm hanging by the door. How oddly the veins crawled over the bones of her fingers. She was wearing an old flannel shirt of gars over her nightgown. Her hair stood out in a wild tangle. When she reached the bedroom door, she stopped to look at Almondine. She'd had some sort of spell in the barn, Edgar had said, but Almondine was fine. She lay there, resting, showing none of the inward look of a dog in pain. She was just old. Edgar needed to start babying Almondine, stop expecting her to have the energy she'd had 5 years ago. Trudy thought of the very first night Almondine spent in that house, a bumbling 10-week-old. There'd been a thunderstorm, she remembered, and Almondine had whined half the night, frightened and lonely for her littermates. Now her muzzle had grayed, and she couldn't stand up quickly after a long sleep. But her gaze was as steady and clear as it had ever been. That gaze was what had made them choose her out of all the other pups. Nowadays, it seemed to take in more than Almondine could possibly express, and it gave her a sad, pensive look. Trudy closed the bedroom door behind her. She dragged a twist of linen across her shoulders and lay back. Someone was coming. Paige? No, Claude. There'd been a dogfight. She had tried to get Edgar to explain as he maneuvered her back to the house, but he said he would explain later, and she lacked the strength to argue. More and more he was his father's son, so certain he was right. In the morning she would call Dr.